Hello and welcome to the Systematic Understanding of Everything, an Exalted podcast. This show is a collaborative effort between members of The Bonus Experience, The Story Told, and Mage the Podcast. We're going to break down the basics of Exalted, from its rules to its setting. I'm Chaz, Exalted writer and fan.
And I'm Monica, 3rd edition supplement developer and lead mechanical developer for Exalted Essence.
I'm Terry, producer for the show, and I recently discovered that after this we are going to do a series of episodes that go between the cardinal and ordinal directions and do Exalted North by Northwest. Just kidding! Trying to see if I can kill my co-hosts.
This is episode 25, Where Fire Marches to the Sea. Today, we're going to take a tour of the Southwest. Like our other episodes on the between directions, this one's going to be a little lighter than the cardinal directions that were always the focus in previous editions.
What is the elemental or narrative theme of the Southwest, and how is it expressed?
The Southwest is pulled between the oceans of the West, influenced by the pull of water, and the heat of the South, influenced by the pull of fire. There are tropical jungles and rainforests, a series of islands called the Cinder Isles that on the map actually look like leaping flames, which is kind of neat, and volcanic islands smoldering in the seas.
The Southwest really has a Southeast Asia going for it, I think.
Yes, definitely.
I see you nodding in agreement.
the whole Ring of Fire, or specifically just like northwest of Australia? Or something.
If you wanted to be inspired by anything in that whole Ring of Fire, you could find a place for it in the Southwest.
Definitely.
Okay, so you could do both Polynesia and like Micronesia and Melanesia without doing a colonialism.
Yeah.
Nice.
Pre-colonial Philippines, too. Vietnam as well.
Yep.
Yeah.
What are the key cities and cultures of the Southwest?
We'll start at the top with Antang, which is a tropical dynastic tourist location, the idea of dynastic tourism is something that is kind of absent anywhere else, which makes Antang a little bit novel. But beyond it being a vacation spot for the rich and famous, it also has a whole bunch of dark political undercurrents fomenting beneath the class's surface. So it's sort of like if Orlando were its own series of islands. On the surface, the Tengis are loyal to the realm, the Scarlet Dynasty, but there is dissent that is building. And some of the wild details about what this new political current of dissent entails are just a few little things, like a developing Yozi cult, an ancient dragon buried in the mountains, war elephants, and guerrilla forces made of humans and spirits.
Wait, war elephants made out of gorillas and humans?
No, they're two different things. Oh, okay. They have war elephants, that's one thing, that's pretty fucking rad. And two, they have guerrilla forces, like with the U.
Not like beast men.
No, that's somewhere else.
Okay.
Guerrilla forces with an O is...
I mean, it's ambiguous in this setting. I just like to point that out.
Those gorilla with a U and an E fighters are both humans and spirits, which is worse than just regular humans. Which makes Antang both the ideal location for a whole campaign, because you have all this political unrest and, like, they're sort of servants to the dynasty, and, like, you know, you could do a whole thing with the idea of the realm as a colonialist power being in oppression there and, like, kissing their asses and all that. But it is also the ideal location for a beach episode.
Yep. Yeah. There was also a bit in second edition where they got really deep into, like, the ancient history of Antang with how it was loyal to the Solars during the usurpation and so suffered particularly under the shogunate, being the reason it has been so tightly controlled by the Dragon-Blooded. And I think that's fine as ancient history, but, like, it's ancient history, so things like that don't tend to continue to be important 1,500 years down the line.
Yeah.
Chaz, let me introduce you to a little setting called Exalted, where the past is never the past.
Hey, just because we wrote it a few years ago doesn't mean it was a few years ago in setting. Bluehaven is a floating pirate city built from the husks of ancient First Age ships trapped in a Sargasso Sea. Its location and the hidden dangers beneath the waters shift with the currents. The city is home and capital to the Lintha, fearsome pirates associated with demons who command supernatural powers, like commanding storms, harnessing sea monsters, and running across the water. 2E got really deep into them being the descendants of a primordial species called the Lintha, who were the chosen of Kimberi. These are different Lintha than the modern Lintha. But third edition's take makes them less explicitly connected to the Yozis.
Yeah, rad infernalist pirates is kind of all you need to know.
Yep. They're fun.
Yep. Lave is a realm port granting access to the Cinder Coast. It's built carved into the mountainous petrified corpse of an ancient primal spirit. That's fucking metal as hell. The sorcerer architects of the past preserved the essence of the behemoth's humors, carving each organ to form a related function for the city. The city is beset by demon cults that the Immaculate Order has never been able to suppress entirely. The monks at the large temple specialize in demonology and exorcism, which sounds like they would need to when you are living in a petrified body.
One of the things that I liked about its presentation in the core, in kind of a nice moment of nuance, is they're like, rooting all of this out would require burning the population to the ground, and the Immaculate Order is not willing to do that. And so they focus on the most dangerous elements of the demon cults and kind of let the low-level shit slide. The Fortress of the Fullgate Spire is a lunar dominion new in Fangs at the Gate. That is a fortress city that moves between rocky islands as lightning during storms. It is home to Ul the Burning Eye and his Komodo Dragonfolk followers. Ul unleashes diseases among the mortal populace, but prevents mortalities through deals with the disease gods. Those pacts also protect guests to the fortress, but intruders are struck by the hundreds of plagues that pass among its population. It's kind of neat because it's a silver-packed stronghold that is close to the realm, being just west of Bluehaven.
What does silver-packed stronghold mean?
The Silver Pact is the mutual aid society of the Lunars, and so in this case it's a place where they can go and be safe from assault from the realm that is not too far away from relevant stuff.
Okay, so that's a case of synecdoche. It's not like the Silver Pact magically manifests there in some way.
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Once an empire, Jajun was carved up as a series of satrapies by the realm over the last century. 50 years ago, the High Queen of Zhao married a scion of House Nemon to end the wars of conquest and bring the rest of Greater Zhao under realm control. The new capital, Golden Seal, is the richest and most cosmopolitan city of the region. Lavish palaces and temples perched on the hills overlook the sprawling, swampy city. Buildings in the lower regions are built on stilts, which is also very cool.
To my understanding, Zhaoyun was the setting for Eric's home game, which he was able to write up in detail for the realm. There's truly a ton of information crammed into this section that can help you bring Zhaoyun to life. The Cinder Isles and accompanying peninsulas host diverse city-states and petty empires that are mentioned in a couple of places yet, but haven't gotten in a ton of detail. So far, they seem to me like they could be a maritime counterpart to the Hundred Kingdoms with an insert-your-own-place-here feel that feels very, like, archaic Eastern Mediterranean.
You could run Aegon here. I'm not obsessed, you're obsessed.
Terry's Aegon fixation. Oh. The Bronze Tide was introduced in Fangs at the Gate. This coalition of peoples is fleeing the oncoming Fairfolk invasion of Beer Empress Badri, led by Luca Palash, Changing Moon Lunar Warchief, who vowed to lead his people to safety. They loot the cities in their path to take supplies they need to survive and find a new homeland beyond Badri's reach. This section includes a ton of detailed information about the Grey Eye Peninsula and a bunch of cultures and city-states of the region, and details about several of Badri's 12 champions.
Reviewing this for the episode, I think there's enough detail in Fangs at the Gate that you could run an entire campaign following the Bronze Tide, even going so far as like rewinding events to an earlier starting point and rolling things forward as Badri pushes the peoples of the region north and west.
The Call is sacred to both Dragonblooded and Lunars, perhaps as the place where Luna and Gaia fell in love. The shrine cities of the Call offer a swelling of power to those dragon-blooded or lunars who complete their trials. For centuries, the Empress ensured the realm's strength was enough to repel the lunars' strikes, but with the Great Houses calling back their legions in her absence, the Silver Pact seized all of the shrine cities at the port of Fashai. Fashai on the Call, the Wall City called that for the ancient glyph-scribed walls that encircle it, is the last city held by the dragon-blooded. Dragon-blooded or lunars can undertake the sacred pilgrimage to the Call's shrine cities. For Dragon-Blooded, this ensures their next child will also exalt. Since lunars have not held the shrine cities since before the usurpation, the books...
The Earth Shrine is the only building in Fashai built directly on the soil. Those who start the pilgrimage must descend into the shrine to be judged by its power. They step onto the earth and turn back, and when they return from the shrine, more time has passed than their simple descent. The unworthy leave aged or wither away to dust when they touch the earth.
Garyangis, the Garden of Dreams, a city overgrown and merged with lush forest life. The Wood Shrine is a massive tree at the city's center. To face the trial, the pilgrim dreams a hunt and must catch and then kill their quarry to open the gates of the shrine.
And that quarry is truly killed and found dead on the shrine before they enter its gates. Hoshu, the pyre that consumes itself, burns nightly within a mile of the fire shrine. The city reappears whole again at sunrise. Only those who remain in the city to be consumed by the flames, suppressing their instinct to flee the pain, may proceed.
Sakima, the Whisper of Memory, is a city in memory only, appearing in the mind of any who enter its bounds to recall their time in a city that no longer exists. Those who build ties to the memory may petition for entry to the Air Shrine.
Mililun, the reflection of self, rises as opal and pearl towers from a mirror-reflected lake, where the reflections are subtly different than in creation. By day, the water reflects the stars, and by night, the sun shines from the lake's surface. At the water shrine, pilgrims face their reflection, a vision of a self who made a different choice at a critical moment, and they must accept that that is also the person that they are in order to enter the reflected shrine.
Wait, what? A version who made a different choice and must accept that they are also the person. So, wait, what?
It's saying that if things had, the reflections are subtly different, and that they have to find themselves among the reflections and recognize that their self that made a different choice at a critical point in their life is still who they are, even though they didn't walk that path. And then in becoming one with their reflection, they can enter the shrine, which only exists as a reflection otherwise.
Interesting. So this is like just a Gatimian making mirror water hole that further douses the fundamental epistemological questions of identity raised by Exalted that are never addressed up to 11. Got it.
And it, yes. Like every shrine does that to some extent.
Oh yeah, this is some real Invisible Sun shit. I'm eating this stuff up.
Feng Yi, the last city, is the end of the pilgrimage, and the way only opens when the time is right. To merely walk there reveals only stately ruins. Some pilgrims wait years while the way opens, but for others it's within hours. Those who enter return changed, an air of sacred insight about them, for the way to Feng Yi is open in their heart.
Aww.
The realm goes into more detail about each of the shrine cities and the lunars who now hold them against the realm.
Fangs at the Gate also gives the insight into the Call from the lunar perspective. Beyond the shrine cities, the matrilineal Kalborn clans, their beastfolk cousins, inhabit the island continent. Muravath, City of a Thousand Faces, shifts with the faces of the moon from the gleaming towers of the full moon to the light-eating towers of the new moon. Sha'a Okaz, lion folk, reclaimed the city from the wilderness, but now it is a haven to many clans of Kalborn and the beastfolk of the island. Untamed spirits, native elementals, freed demons, and fair folk inhabit the wilderness of the Call, which resists Yushan's efforts to assign proper gods to rule over it.
What interesting or notable historical events happened in the Southwest?
Well, the conquests of the Zhao to form Greater Zhaoyun was in the wake of the Seven Tigers Rebellion, which we talked about last time in the South. The Zhao were allies of the Seven Tigers, and when the Scarlet Empress destroyed them. They went west over the mountains and built their little empire until centuries later the realm began its slow imperial conquest of the region. So you've also had the slow march of the realm down the coast to seize more and more of this territory. You also have the reappearance of the cowl. It disappeared at some point in the past and reappeared in the early centuries of the realm. So like 500 years ago, it was just gone for a long time. And along with the cowl, like everybody on it also disappeared and cannot explain where they were in the absence of the cowl. And now it's back, and it's weird. This is definitely a let's keep creation weird space.
What things would draw a circle or a character to the Southwest?
That differs by area, with each having their own different and interesting hooks. Obviously, you have the call being appealing to both Dragonblooded and Lunars to fight for control of the island, and as, of course, the soul purging pilgrimage. Onteng could be a haven to Solars, especially if they helped overthrow the realm. The Cinder Coast offers a lot of the same distance benefits as the Dreaming Sea, but leaves the realm a little bit closer if you want to bring it into your game.
What makes the local economy of the Southwest special?
Honestly, I'm not quite sure. I think there's a mix of valuable trade goods that are far away from other parts of creation and easy coastal trade. But in this case, there isn't like one thing that makes the economy.
I remember from looking up earlier, the Onteng also says they export rice to the realm, plus also tourism. But that's just that one area. If there's not like the whole of the Southwest provides the realm legions with salted fish.
What interesting characters or gods live in the Southwest?
Sha'a Oka, the Black Lion, a new lunar elder, disappeared with the cowl and reappeared with it as well. He has died many times, but returns to lead the Silver Pact on the cowl each time. Plays politics with the other Shahanyas only to strengthen his centuries-long war against the realm to reclaim the shrine cities of the cowl.
And this is where we again suffer being between the major directions. We have some area-specific characters for Onteng and the Lintha that came from 2nd edition, the Sha'uka's war leaders on the call, and a few key players in Jiayun, but nothing in the way of signature characters or major gods. We'll get to all those when we do the West.
Indeed we shall. Terry, what interesting creatures, natural or supernatural, did you find living in the Southwest?
Okay, so this first one contains a content warning for bad things that may or may not have happened to small kids. So fast forward 30 seconds if you don't like that. There's something called the Walker Among the Trees, which are 50-foot tall creatures made out of bamboo who are animated by the spirit of kids who I'm just going to say didn't make it. They're childlike spirits. If their remains are placed in a certain spot, their spirit may enter the surrounding flora and turn into what I'm going to call is a badass ass-kicking bamboo elemental that it watches over their parents and attacks anything they view as having a problem with them, which includes like realm tax collectors, which like I could almost hear the author going wink when I read over that in that section. The desert basilisk, who are apparently this is basilisk but with a C instead of whatever letter basilisk normally ends with, I think a K, and they seem to be kind of like the drama queens of the desert. They are solitary reptilian creatures that hate every other living thing, including other basilisks, and the book is even like, no one knows how they produce, real noodle scratcher, wink. They have wings, they can't fly, they have a corona of flame that damages everyone nearby, which I assume, again, is a metaphor for spending too much time with dramatic people. Once they've determined that someone is their quarry, they will pursue them ceaselessly, even to a crowded city, which makes me just picture this desert basilisk going, no, I need to kill this motherfucker now, he's going faster than me now, he's in a major city, I'm going to have to get new shoes, this is bullshit, the entire time. They can live quite a long time, and the elderly among them can learn to understand simple commands and speak simple words. So I like the idea of a slightly snarky desert basilisk who you've partnered up with to chase down someone that it has decreed is its enemy and just mutters curses around the campfire. There is the tree strider, which is some sort of dinosaur tree raptor. Sure. They can't be ridden, which they are specifically stated as a thing that can happen, but they can be domesticated. And I would like to be a pedant here and note that it said domesticated and not tamed, which means they can breed in captivity and probably express neoteny, which means eventually we're going to have versions of them that meow and have fluffy ears. And I kind of like that. It also mentions specifically that they will consume the weak and the sleeping.
And that I'm doesn't like, sound too domesticated.
Yeah. I don't consider cats domesticated. I'm just putting that out there. They're wild animals that happen to be willing to have sex in our houses and then shit in boxes.
I live with two very domesticated very cats, domesticated so cats. I would have to argue with you.
Okay, pardon me. The entirety of the species is not domesticated. I'll put it that way.
Just the two that live in my house.
Just
are.
The two. Yes. Monica has 1/3 of all known truly domesticated cats. And then there is Sela the Yellow Worm, which is a 40-foot long lizard that lives in the southwest border marches. It has an essence of 9. And like considering like a badass Exalt will have an essence of like 3. That seems like a lot. Its moat pool is 135. 135 is a big number even in Exalted terms. They trap spirits within their claws and can attack you with the spirit attached to the claw and protects a vast hoard of Ysal crystals. Those are the ones that store essence, right?
Yes.
That's the actual essence battery.
Stick yeah. spirits in them too.
Like, the other thing about the description is because in the 2e books there's such a clear division between the stats and the description, like it doesn't necessarily come across how this thing should be presented, because like there was that one time where it's like, ah, slow and lumbering is this zombie creature, but you look at the stats and you're like, it has an intelligence of 7. Like, you mean this in a physical sense. It is quite adroit in a debate. And this was one of those. This is a dragon with 3 dots of bureaucracy. So like, it is more competent in terms of those things than most of the people operating the realm. And those were my favorite creatures.
Very nice.
Thank you, as always, for doing the creature rundown.
I'm glad to.
There is also another creature worth noting in association with Alintha. In second edition, their ships were pulled by demonic sea worms. And I think demonic sea worms that pull ships is worth mentioning.
I agree completely.
Chaz, if we want more information about the Linthans and demonic sea worms, do you have a recommended resource for that?
Oh boy, don't I. They appear in The Fall of Giara.
That was a pretty good one. There was a sense of like brooding and menace that the series had otherwise been lacking when Chaz is like, I can't hear over the sound of me going, fuck you! It was pretty great. I strongly recommend it. Link will be in the show notes. So, story ideas? Monica, do you have something that you would like to do in the Southwest?
I definitely think an Antang game, either as let's just pick one of the 50 weird things that is happening here, especially for, let's go with an essence mixed circle game, you have all sorts of weird, ripe things to do there, or like I said earlier in the episode, beach episode.
Yeah. The rice up.
Both at the same time.
Yeah. How about you, Chaz?
So I have a lot of thoughts here, and I kind of want to take a step back and really appreciate the way that third edition has created regions within a direction, not just placing the city as, oh yeah, this is the city and it interacts with the 6 other cities in the south, but here is a whole region. Like Zhaoyun presents a city, but it also gives a history. It says that there's this whole valley and there's other neighboring cities, multiple realm satrapies. It gives you a little bit about how they interact. And it just gives you a ton of interconnected information that really zooms in. You get the same thing when you look at the Bronze Tide or when you look at the Call. So any of those gives you kind of just a ripe full setting to explore and never leave and have the same depth that you could have across an entire direction in previous editions in a much smaller area. So I really appreciate that and think that I could take the details presented in the 3E content so far for any of those locations and run a cool and interesting campaign. But then I'm also going to cheat for this because I've had a homebrew location kind of percolating in my head now for a while that I have placed in the southwest on the peninsula north of Antang, where my thinking for this is there's a lot of places where the dragon-blooded are seen as oppressors and they present themselves as heroes, what would it actually look like if they were heroes? What would the conditions need to be? And so I came up with this idea that there's some kind of like demon gate to Malphys that some demons can escape from that was built during the First Age, and the Dragonblooded don't have the power to shut the gate or don't know how to shut the gate. And so you have a whole kingdom that is beset by threats from beyond, and the Dragonblooded there really do get to be the heroes. But the interesting thing with this in kind of the modern era where the great houses are pulling all of their forces together is that the only Dragonblooded who would stay there would be the ones who really cared about protecting the people, because everyone else is just going to go back and deal with politics. And I think that opens an interesting space for a mixed circle game where you would have a Dragonblooded establishment that would be potentially willing to work with the other exalt types for the greater good. And I think that would be a really interesting microcosm to explore.
My thought is kind of like the bad version of that, in that this feels like the direction where it is not easy to be immortal. Like, there are other directions with a lot of natural hazards, but this one feels like there's a lot of supernatural hazards to it. And I could see the fact that the realm doesn't seem to be active to be a place where the Solar Deliberative or something like it kind of gets recreated. And we just get this little microcosm of the First Age that kind of appears in all the bad ways. Where you have Solars who start being worshipped as gods, because unless we worship the Solar who keeps the Harvest God, that is literally the only way we can get... There is no natural process by which we can get enough food to survive. So it goes from this is our hero to this is our king to this is our god. And it just completely recreates that and kind of acts as a... maybe a warning to the rest of the Solars to be like, oh shit, it happened again. Because again, this is exalted, so nothing that ever happened in the past is truly ever in the past. And kind of similar, where it's just the same old plagues. And to quote the phrase, when the elephants fight, it's the grass who suffers.
That sounds like a really cool idea, too.
Thank you. Real short one. Anything else before we roll out?
I'm good.
Yeah, well, again, this is an area that I am excited to see more of. There have been bits hinted at of the Cinder Isles and some of the other areas of the region. So I'm excited to see what Across the Eight Directions brings to expand the Southwest.
Okay, so what is our next system episode and what is our next direction episode then?
Our next system episode is a grab bag of all the little systems that we haven't talked about yet. So that'll be a fun one. And then our final direction episode is talking about the West proper.
Nice. And while people are waiting for that, Monica?
Yeah.
Where can people find out what you're up to?
You can follow me on Twitter. I am at ZenithSun. While we are recording this, Blazeball is off for 2 weeks, so I will be back on Twitter for a while. And then it's going to be back on for 3 weeks. Fuck Twitter again. But you can also listen to me talk about game design. With this season of my show, we're reading small indie games and reviewing them. So if both design talk and game reviews sound appealing to you, check out Bonus Experience, which you can find at bxpcast.com.
And how about you, Chaz?
You can find me on Twitter as @StoryToldChaz, and I have been making an effort to tweet more and to tweet things that I hope would be interesting to people interested in gaming. You can also, as always, find me on The Story Told. We are currently in our final stretch of episodes for The Fall of Giara, which is exciting. I think I have probably like 5 sessions left, which means 10 more episodes, plus the 3 that have already been recorded. So it'll still be a while before you get to the end of it, but it's exciting to start wrapping to the end of the campaign.
Nice. Early 2022. We're going to see how that shit ends, he says, his eye twitching.
I expect it to be over before the end of the year.
Okay. I wish you well in that regard.
Considering this was supposed to be done in 2019, we'll see how it goes.
We only went over our initial run by what? Twice? 50%? Was our original target 8 or 16 episodes?
I think it was like 10. Okay. So yeah, we're... We're way over.
Eh. Who cares? Oh, well. Speaking of things that have carried on much longer than they should, find out about Mage the Ascension, a game thoroughly set in the 90s, at magethepodcast.com or follow me on Twitter at Terry Robinson. Thank you for listening to Systematic Understanding of Everything, an Exalted podcast. Go to exaltcast.com to subscribe, see our show notes, or listen to our past episodes. We're available on iTunes, Spotify, YouTube, and Anchor.fm. If you have a question, shoot us an email at questions@exaltcast.com. If you'd like to support our show, please consider using the affiliate links in our show notes to make purchases on DriveThruRPG and thestorytellervault.com. The opening theme is Return of the Solar Exalted, and the closing theme is the Sidereal Exalted Lesser But Safe from Fanfare for the Chosen by James Semple and is used with permission. In the meantime, exalt strong.